Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
On this episode of Entertainment Education, the podcast, the one with narratives and literature, we explore how narratives and literature intersect with entertainment education in the classroom to create a movement and social change. This episode blends scholarly insight with playful exchanges, offering both educators and literature fans a thoughtful conversation on how stories teach, transform, and entertain. Grab your favorite book and cozy up in your favorite chair to read, as my co-authors for this episode are Dr. Aaron Mann, Dean of Humanities and Fine Arts, and Michelle Anya Angerbag, lecturer and researcher in fantasy.
Help. Spanish. You're taking 12th grade calculus?
Yeah, I like math.
Ew, why?
Because it's the same in every country.
It's beautiful.
Entertainment Education, the podcast, an eight-part series where host Alan Babiarz Lyra will take you through the journey of how entertainment can educate and create social change.
Oh, yes, the past can hurt. But the way I see it, you can either run from it or learn from it.
Hello, episode 7 of Entertainment Education, the podcast. I cannot believe we are almost done with the season. We only have one episode left after this. But I don't want to jump into that yet because it's Disney, my favorite subject. Today, we do have a very exciting show. I know I say that every week, my friends, but we really, really do. We're going to be talking about how narratives and literature can teach and affect social change in a classroom and through society. And I've got some really interesting, fun guests with me today. First, let me say hello to Dr. Aaron Mann, who is the Dean of Humanities and Fine Arts at Ball State Community College and a former English professor themselves. Hello, Aaron. How are you?
Hey, Alan. I'm doing great. Thanks.
Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And secondly, I have a lecturer and a researcher in fantasy, which is fun narrative play that we got out there. We have Michelle Anya Angerbag. I know I butchered that. I am so sorry.
It's fine.
Welcome. Angerbag, right?
Angerbag, yes. And thank you so much for having me here.
Oh, thank you for joining us today. If you guys are ready, I say let's jump in. Aaron, I will start with you. And I like to start in the back, all the way going back. Little Aaron, yay hi. When did your passion for stories, literature, narratives, things like that begin?
I don't remember a time that I wasn't interested in reading. I was a little Aaron was quite the nerd, liked to read books, and that sort of persisted throughout. And I don't know if you want to attribute that to being the oldest child who got a lot of parental attention, and so you're super verbal and super interested. My parents were big readers, and so they read to me a lot when I was small, and never stopped from there. As soon as I could read on my own, that's what I was doing all the time.
I'm going to pose the same question to you, Michelle Anya. When did your passion begin, and Has it kind of been the like Aaron the same?
Yeah, it's what she said has really resonated with my own experience. I don't remember a time in my life when I couldn't read, and I read everything I was allowed to get my hands on, and it never really stopped. I don't know, Aaron, if you feel the same way, but it doesn't feel like it's going to stop.
Yes.
So
Everything I could, yes, everything I could get my hands on, whether I was supposed to have my hands on it or not.
yes, absolutely. The wonderful moment of being chased out of the adult section of the
Yes.
public library.
Yes.
Luckily, my mom was very much a "don't tell my child what she can and can't read. If it's not for her, she'll get bored" kind of parent style. So, yeah, just and she was right.
Yeah.
Also, Mists of Avalon, not a great book to pick up when you're 10.
Oh, yeah, I think I think I was a couple of years behind on that one, but I definitely remember reading that earlier than I should have. And then in retrospect, maybe never should have, but it is what it
Yep.
is.
No, absolutely. It was that moment of going, I don't know what's happening. Put it back.
Yep.
And great.
Well, you know, that makes me think of my niece. She's 2.5 years old, and she's going through, and she's got these great books, and she's going through, and she doesn't know a word what they say on there, but she's reading them to herself. And it also helps with memory because she listens to these stories and she just recites them now every night because she remembers them from the same stories that she loves as she's going through. So it becomes a way of teaching, obviously. Aaron, can you share an example of like a novel or a story that taught you something meaningful but also kept you entertained?
So I am, especially now in my adulthood, now that I have finished my graduate studies and my compulsory reading for the most part, I can't stick with a book or a story that isn't inherently entertaining. So I kind of assume entertaining as a basis. Like unless I have to read it for work, I'm not going to read something that's boring. And I think it's fine to say that. I think students would find that a little bit shocking to say, like, you don't have to march through your adult life the way that you've marched through your schooling and be bored. But I mean, there's so everything is entertaining, or I stop reading it. And then the premise of my life as someone who has taught and continues to teach is that you can learn from every text, right? Literature is inherently educational, regardless of whether it's capital L literature or genre fiction or whatever. So I think to some extent, I could just give you a list of everything I've read this year and it would be both entertaining and educational. But I think, in recent years, my reading has veered more toward, I'm making an effort to read more women, more writers of color. So I've gotten really into Jesmyn Ward. Like, I think that she is maybe the best living novelist there is. And I just love, like, her prose is so stunning. And like her most recent one, Let Them Descend, I really loved because she was really playing around with some religious tropes and but it was the story of this girl who was experiencing life as an enslaved person, and it was just so deeply impactful, right? Like I just felt so touched by it, right? And I have no, like, that is so far from my concept of the world. Like, that is, I'm a 44-year-old white woman living in Tennessee. Like, I have every privilege in the world. I have no idea what that experience was like. And I felt like she was able to really drive that home for me in the minutes that I was in that book, in those pages. And I never expected that, right? Like, that's not something that I have to think about on a daily basis, but to have that brought home was really just so remarkable. And so that's the kind of experience I'm looking for. And I guess I don't know that I would call that entertaining per se, although like I was yanked through the pages of that book, but it certainly was compelling and educational and has stuck with me.
Well, then I would ask you the opposite. And you've both hit on it a little bit already. I know Michelle said, you know, if I don't find it interesting within the first, you know, whatever, it's going back on the shelf. So have you found that it was so boring or the message was just so bad that you just had to put it back at that moment?
Yes. I'm trying to think of an example and I kind of don't, I mean, I don't want to drag anyone through the mud, but like it's just sometimes it's just not the moment for it, for either because of me or because of the book, or the writing doesn't click, or I just am not, yeah, I'm not in the mood, or I start and it's not what I expected, and therefore I don't want it. I don't know.
So, do you think that our students then relate the same way?
Yes, except more so because I think so many of them have never experienced pleasure while reading, right? Like, have never felt that entertainment piece of it, right? Like, reading has always been something that they have been required to do, have been forced to do, have been seeking to avoid, right? Like, coming up with ever more elaborate avoidance strategies, right? And so there's no, this is going to sound dark, but like there's no hope for them, right? There's no hope. Like maybe if I just open this up and I stick with it for a chapter, it's going to suck me in. It's going to become something that is really like enjoyable, even if it's not going to stick with me forever. Like I think a lot of them approach reading in particular, at least from my experience in the literature classroom, as a chore and nothing more. I don't know, Michelle, have you had that?
Yeah, I'm in the interesting position where what I've been teaching most recently over the last few years is I'm either working with kind of master's students or people who have really chosen in like, a very kind of pressurized university environment that we are studying literature or children's literature, and we're very into what we're doing. So we're very, very focused and driven on this topic, which of course is it's the same kind of reader that I was. But then the other group of students I've worked with predominantly has been study abroad students in London. And when you go on study abroad, you're fulfilling your gen eds. You are not there. Like, study is like a in parentheses for a lot of these students when they get here, which, it's fine. Like, I totally get it. And I also have to be the person at the front of the room going, look, you want to explore, but we also have to do this because that's the rules, and we need to find a way that we're going to do this together. And I remember having a conversation a few semesters ago. The course I've been teaching for study abroad is called Fantasy in the Real World. So it's literature through the sociological lens. I love it. I'm heavily biased, but it does have a 14 novel list. Now, I will qualify that it is all children's novels and young adult novels. I am not giving them 14 volumes of James and Proust, and we're not delving into the things that I myself will not read for pleasure. Or, it's not been the time in my life where I've encountered those for pleasure yet. And we watch shows, we watch movies, we kind of take media at large and relate it to that idea of story and narrative and how it reflects the real world. But the conversation I keep having to have when one student volunteered, I can't remember the last time I've ever been asked to read a book cover to cover. We start talking about, you kind of you use it or lose it. Like, you, why do we need this as a skill? Number one, it's fun. It enriches your brain. It makes you see the world in a different way. But the other one is like, one day you're going to hopefully have to read through something like a contract or a mortgage or, terms and services or something that can be about 45 pages, and you need to have the attention span to know what's going on all the way through. This is the fun playground where you get to flex that muscle. This is, nobody says you have to read business treatises to know how to do that. You just need to work on your attention span a little bit. And I've had, the wonderful after effect of students writing back and saying, I want more. I really liked this. I want more. How do I start to do this? So I think it's one of those things that if we can find the way to help students to be more receptive to the idea of this is something for pleasure. This is not for necessarily only clout. This is not for, doing it to show that you're doing it, but you can have something that is quiet and in front of you and off a screen or on a screen or on an audiobook. I'm not picky. I don't know if Erin, you found this with students. Sometimes you don't need to have it in the book form, and sometimes alternative formats are great for many reasons. But the idea of being able to be open to continuing and seeing what's going to happen without instant gratification, that's like the biggest point of negotiation I have with students in reading. Yeah, there's just a lot of different facets to it, I think. And of course, it's not a catch-all either. I kind of want to qualify that. Like, every single student is going to be different, and then every bit of group dynamic is going to also impact how we all enter those narrative spaces and handle those narrative spaces together. So there's no hard and fast. I think there's just being ready for whatever's thrown at you in that dynamic and making the best of it. And it's collaborative, but.
You know, that's been kind of a reoccurring theme that we've talked about through every episode, not intentionally, but attention spans are getting shorter, and all of us in the educational setting are trying to find other resources to keep our students' attention. Absolutely. We had an episode 4 dealt with AI, and AI is super changing how we are, you know, doing anything. So check it out. Episode 4. Go back. Listen. Michelle, if you don't mind, I'll stick with you for a few more minutes. Do you think, in your opinion, there are any particular like genres or themes? I know you teach fantasy a lot. Do you think there are any genres that lend themselves better to education than others?
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
I mean, so you hit it in the framing of your question. I like fantasy. That was my wheelhouse as a child. That was what I kept reading. That's where my brain goes to for how do I want to grapple with the questions of what do we owe to each other as society, as a culture, as people. So that is what I teach, kind of like what Erin was saying before, like she's not gonna read something if she doesn't like it right now. She doesn't have to. If I'm designing my syllabus, why would I drag myself back through books that I don't like? I think all genres have their uses and their utilities and their points where they can inspire students. Not everyone's a fantasy person. Not everyone wants speculative fiction at all. Some people really love realist fiction, that kind of touch into the world. Some people love historical fiction because it awakens things that maybe they learned about in history classes or they've had interest in the past. True crime right now is still having this massive genre moment. Different genres work differently for different people. And I would really, really hesitate before saying one thing works better, because I think that gets rid of the idea that people, and especially reluctant readers or new readers, can find things that they love. Because I think one of the hardest things with getting people engaged in reading is that if they feel like they're being judged for what they like, they're not going to keep doing it. And we are a very judgmental society right now. We are a very critical society. Everything is for the aesthetic of it in some ways. Or at least that's what I found with my students, is like everything's about what does it look like to other people that I'm doing. And so I try to frame that as like, you know, we're using fantasy because I have 15 weeks and I can't give you everything. And I'm not even giving you all a fantasy. We're having a very narrow look, because this is what I like. But you can absolutely go find similar themes and we could do this whole class in any genre. We could pull this from any form of literature and we'd still be able to have similar conversations. And I think that's something to remember. Yeah.
That is an important factor that our students sometimes overlook, is that we teach them these concepts and we can put anything, any particular subject within these concepts, right? Like if I'm teaching you interpersonal communication, I can bring in Disney and teach you a whole bunch of interpersonal communication. I can bring in something as, well, to me it's boring, but something as boring as like cars and trucks and Henry Ford, and bring that in and put the same concepts in and still teach them that same lesson. And sometimes they need to open their vision maybe a little bit broader than just looking at the page in front of them. Yes, they have fantasy in front of them, but let's look a little bit broader. What lessons can we teach from this? What lessons can we get from this. So I 1000% agree. One thing I would love to see more of is a combination of these big franchises, and I'm talking like Star Wars and like big like that in the classroom. Like I grew up in the late 90s, early 2000s in high school, and I learned driver's ed from these old videos and these old people, like 1970s cameras, and it was really bad, right? If I could learn how to drive from like Han Solo driving the Millennium Falcon, like that would keep my attention. I would be going and it would be fantastic. So I think there needs to be a little bit more bringing of that into the classroom, in my opinion.
I'm not sure I would say that Han Solo is the driver that I want.
No. We're gonna
you'll learn how to drive from Han Solo. That is not good for anybody else on the road.
That would be great. No, like Han on purpose, because he, you know, steals the Millennium Falcon and
not what I would call a defensive driver.
No.
I stick by my point. Aaron, I'm gonna jump to you for a minute. What are some advantages, and then also on the other side, some disadvantages of bringing some educationally driven narratives into the classroom versus something like just for the entertainment purposes?
I'm still thinking about, Michelle, what you were saying about clout and kind of approachability and boredom, right? And so I think there's this super under-acknowledged tension between, especially in literature, right? Between we need you to read the capital C classics, like we need you to read the things that have cultural capital, versus we should admit that we can teach you the skills of literary analysis and critical thinking with any narrative text, right? Like nobody does it really, but I could bring a handful of romance novels, which is, I would posit, maybe the most derided genre fiction, into the classroom, and I could very well teach my students critical analysis with those romance novels, and they would be as good at it as a student who spent a semester with Shakespeare and Joyce, and it would be fine, and like they would go about their lives and they would be happy campers, right? So I think that maybe one of the disadvantages is this like defensiveness that instructors who bring genre fiction or quote unquote entertainment level texts into the classroom have to feel, right? There's this sense that you have to defend, you know, if you're teaching young adult literature, which I taught a young adult literature class as well, like I felt like I had to defend, like, okay, you're college students and I'm going to, like, we're going to read through texts that are intended for 12, 13, 14, 15 year olds, right? And there's a reason for that. And there's a reason that we're doing this. And at the same time, like, I'm aware that my students are still reading that, right? Like, there was a huge discussion in my honors class this past semester about Sunrise on the Reaping. Like, they were so excited about the new Hunger Games novel. Like, there was a lot of, don't tell me, I haven't gotten to it yet, when it came out. And so I don't think there are disadvantages to teaching texts that are appealing to students or that are appealing to the instructor or that are just fun, right? And there's still a really intense snobbery in colleges about non-capital L literature that I think really we have to interrogate it, right? You know, I am all for the death of the survey. I don't think surveys serve us or serve our students, right? They're the death march from Beowulf through the Pilgrims. Nobody enjoys that. It's not good. And it teaches our students about a sort of like historical predestination that's not helpful. It teaches them that only certain texts count. It teaches them that literature is suffering. And I'm just not here for it. So I kind of reject the idea that there are disadvantages to teaching texts that are enjoyable. Like, I think pleasure is one of the key values of literature. It is what it's for. We tell stories to enjoy them, right? Like, we tell stories to understand ourselves and we tell stories to make a point and to argue and all that. But really, we tell stories because we love them and because they are fun. And I think we should embrace that more.
You just brought, I'm sorry, I was Gonna say real quick, you brought me some PTSD saying Beowulf. Let me tell you, Beowulf in high school, we were not friends. But yes, no, I agree 1,000%. I'm sorry, Michelle.
No, I just want to kind of jump on two things that, like, based off of what Aaron said. Like, the first is, like, I totally agree that there is this kind of a snobbery or even just like a preoccupation or a fear of, like, self-judgment about teaching certain genres, certain ages. And I'm a fairy tale scholar and a fantasy scholar, and my PhD is in children's literature and media. I kind of had this moment while I was doing my doctorate that I went, if I'm going to apologize or explain everything that I write or I'm interested in, I'm never going to get the chance to say anything. I'm never going to get to step further. So I sort of took the tack of, I don't have to explain myself. It exists. It's literature. It is media. It is in the world. People watch it. And that's the end of it. And if it doesn't meet somebody else's standard, well, they probably don't meet mine on another factor. So I fully agree. We need to look at that more. But yeah, it's the whole premise, of course, of, like, also that capital C classic, that canon. I think we do also need to acknowledge that, like, that is not a neutral space. That is not a neutral construction whatsoever. The idea of what has value or cultural capital or clout, as you were saying, Aaron, like, there's a lot loaded in those concepts. And I very much was the one, I was the one who loved Beowulf. I, during my undergraduate, I was like, yes, I will be a medievalist. And somewhere in the middle of it, I realized I didn't love the archive. I loved watching how the story traveled. Mm-hmm. So I went from this medievalism, this fascination with what was old and what was told, to why are we still telling it? And I landed firmly in popular culture. And it's just this very, very interesting path when I think about it, because I should, as a literature scholar, quotation marks, be more interested in some ways that origin point or the history of it or what gives it power. And yet none of that captures my imagination whatsoever. So again, why would I press that upon a bunch of students who are figuring out where do they stand in relation to this wild and wobbly thing we call a corpus?
I love that, because when I went to graduate school, I thought that I was going to study 20th century women's memoir.
Oh, goodness.
I had done my undergraduate thesis on, and I was set. And then I took a Chaucer class.
Yes.
And I thought, these people are so freaking weird, right? Yes. Like, whatever is happening here is so bizarre that I must know more about it. And so for me, it's almost the reverse of what you're describing in terms of, like, how did this, like, why is this the starting point? Right. And then I went backwards to Beowulf and then got into the very same question that you're talking about, which is how do these stories circulate and travel? Right. And, like, in particular, I was interested in biblical stories, right? It's such a religious time. Yeah. Right. How do we see these stories traveling around? What happens when they show up in a stained glass window or a painting or a, you know,
a YA dystopian novel?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so it's that persistence of us telling ourselves the same stories over and over to understand something. And the question of what are we trying to understand is the same regardless of, you know, what period, what genre, what whatever. So I love that. I love that little parallel. I also think that all medievalists are secretly fantasy sci-fi nerds, and all sci-fi fantasy people are medievalists in waiting.
I don't think it's so secret. I think it's there.
Yeah, it's not. Like,
so you're saying I'm a medievalist in hiding, is what you're
might
saying.
Be. Might
as
be.
As a hoping that Han Solo is going to teach me how to drive one day. Sci-fi is, yes. Michelle, that kind of leads into my next question. And when I wrote this question, I know this isn't the best genre to think about, but what I was thinking about at the time was, in the past, like, 10, 15 years, we've seen, like, 50 Shades of Grey bring out a, like, taboo sex culture in society that wasn't okay before, right? People didn't talk about that before. Harry Potter kind of brought out this young child who is this kind of mixed race, almost, because he's half muggle, half human, or half wizard, and he's going in. And so it's becoming, we're seeing more social change from these books. So, are you seeing more social change in these literary fictions, and how can it create that in culture?
So you've given me kind of like a big runway to, I think,
I know, I did. I
an
am
answer
sorry.
that might not seem like it's going from the question, especially because you picked those two series. So with like 50 Shades of Grey or like conversations around Harry Potter or anything, I will always go back and say, just because something hasn't hit the quote unquote mainstream doesn't mean that conversations haven't been happening. I mean, we can look at queer literature and see massive threads of kink culture really permeating literature and media and subcultures long before 50 Shades of Grey was a Twilight fan fiction. When it comes to Harry Potter, it's again, there for some people who maybe are not familiar with the market, Harry Potter birthed modern fantasy for children. There's 30 years of female written fantasy specifically for children in YA, specifically featuring women and young girl characters. Well before Harry Potter, down to the point where there is actually a wizarding story by Jane Yolen called Wizard's Hall that comes out in the same year as the first Harry Potter. It's a slim version. It's a much, much better school story. Harry Potter is, and I've written about this, Harry Potter is a school story that appeals to a very particular British nostalgia for a certain kind of school story, plus magic. And the more you pull at the threads, it doesn't really hold up as a cultural artifact, and then we put it in its cultural context and the creator's context. What kind of social change is Harry Potter causing in 2025? The author just lobbied to make it illegal to be trans in the UK. So, do we call that positive social change? It's certainly a social change. The literature and the sales of the literature have led to an already heavily minoritized group being doubly criminalized. So what do we think of as social change? So I think
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Yeah. Literature is literature. Media is media. It exists in context. It exists in the context of the creators. I am not somebody who buys into the author is dead until the author is actually dead and their causes are separated from the proceeds of the funds of the literary body. People can take literature to make change. People do the changing. And we know this if we look historically at how Tolkien's works have been used both in fascist circles and anti-fascist circles. If we look at how different kinds of even heavily religiously inflected children's fantasy or science fantasy, like Madeline L'Engle's works, have both been considered deeply problematic and deeply inspirational. Everything's going to depend on context and who is doing what with it. We can look at the kind of rise of the technocrat and where certain CEOs point to different kinds of sci-fi, and we go, well, you didn't understand that the point of Minority Report was to not build the big screening everybody's identities and trying to predict what they were going to do and preemptively arrest the machine. So it's people and their comprehension and their media literacy have the potential to create social change.
That is an important factor you mentioned right there, is media literacy. We haven't mentioned that much yet tonight, but that does play an important factor in how you're reading a book and what message you're receiving, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I know, Aaron, if you've got a perspective on that as well.
Of course, I think you're absolutely right. Like I think that literature and texts are much more a reflection of their society than some sort of intervention on the part, like, even when an author is desperately trying to send a message, right, or write what we would call like didactic literature, there's no guarantee that that's going to work, right? And this is, I mean, we could get into like reader response theory and blah, 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 all those things that you learn in grad school, but really all you need to know is, right, there's what the author writes and then there's what the reader reads, and those things aren't always aligned. And in my viewpoint, what the reader reads can be much more powerful just because there's more readers than there are authors, ideally, if you've written a successful book. But it really is much more of a reflection of what's going on in the society. I'm thinking about a couple of classes that I taught where I brought in, like, I was working with general education students, but I was like, okay, we're gonna try a little bit of literary theory and we're gonna see how it goes. So I don't remember what text we were reading, maybe Godwin and the Green Knight, but I brought in this theorist called Jeffrey Jerome Cohen. He has a fairly famous theory about monsters, right? And basically the premise is whatever monsters are in a text, they reflect some concern that's going on in society at the time. And when monsters pop back up, so like, and you can think about, right, like early to mid 2000s, vampires get really big. We're right in the middle of a huge economic crisis where banks are basically sucking the life out of people, right? And then it's probably not coincidental that we're really interested in vampires in that moment. Why they had to sparkle at that time, I don't know. I'm sure someone has analyzed it, right? And so this idea is that we love a monster, but really the monsters are a reflection of our preoccupations at any given time. And I think that's a much more astute reading. The problem is getting students from I like this or I don't like it to I can analyze this whether I like it or not, and I can see the ways in which it can be used, the ways in which it's reflecting the society. And I think that's the much more challenging piece.
I absolutely agree on that.
Michelle, I'll direct this one to you, but either of you, again, feel free to jump in. Are there any ethical considerations that educators need to keep in mind when bringing in some sensitive topics in narrative form?
Oh, God, yeah. We should be considering ethics with every topic because we don't know what's sensitive to our students. We don't know what their experiences are, and we don't know what somebody carries into the room. Before I was teaching in classrooms, I did leadership development in outdoor education. So I worked with actual narrative gameplay out in the woods with a wide variety of different groups, and we would set up game scenarios. Sometimes they were field games. You know, we have a game that you can either play with, you know, deers versus wolves, or we'd call it deers and wolves, or you have monarchs and peasants. It's the same game. It's a ball game. You run around tagging people. You can play it cooperatively or you can play it antagonistically. And they have to figure out which one they want to do. The story frames how they react to the game in every single context. And that was a very, very early example for me of the story that I tell when I'm putting people under a condition of, in that case, actual stress. They have to work together. They're doing something physical. They're in an environment they don't control. It's unfamiliar. The story that I tell is going to either get them to buy in a way that feels safe and comfortable and we can grow together. Or if I'm not reading the group as I'm telling this story, I'm going to push a button and we're going to lose the work that we've already done. And that is not the student's responsibility to respond in the right way. That is my job as an educator to read a room and understand how I'm directing a conversation. Mm-hmm. And I will hold that that is true of small group work, or if I am lecturing in a theater with 200 people and I can see people's faces, I need to know how am I communicating and am I pushing a button that maybe this is not the time to be pushed. Maybe we need to back off because I'm about to cause some harm. And I think, I'm not saying that we don't have to challenge ourselves and we don't have to create situations that cause a level of challenge in the classroom, but we need to make sure we understand what does it mean to challenge with care and to create situations where our students can choose the level of challenge that they're going to engage in. My fantasy in the real world class, we talk about everything from chattel slavery to child marriage to, you know, different kinds of all of the isms to family harm. We cover absolutely everything, but we have tap out methods. We have the ability for students to just not even say anything, but decide they need a 5-minute break from the classroom and talk to me afterwards. We have fail safes built into, we know this is going to be a class that's going to push some buttons and challenge people, especially when they're in that familiar space of study abroad, where they're already being challenged on a bodily level every day, even if they don't recognize it, they're somewhere new. Culture doesn't work in the exact way that they're used to. And I work with some amazing administrators who have helped me build an environment where if we're going to do challenging things, we also have everything we need to wrap them up with afterward and go, are we okay? Not are you okay and you, I'm judging you because you something happened, but are we okay as a learning community? Can we trust each other to have these conversations? So yeah, I personally start with community conversations and contracts about how we're all going to talk to each other in a classroom. It's we write it together on the board sort of thing. How are we going to recognize that everybody in this room is a person with their own experiences? And we don't know what's going to be tricky. So how do we care for each other first? And that for me, if that's not coming first, we're not doing our jobs, especially with literature.
You know, I feel sometimes, I'm going to tiptoe around this, but sometimes some authors forget about that. I was reading a book actually for when I was taking the entertainment education course, and the book was written during COVID, the COVID times, and it was very much about a country releasing biological warfare into the air through a virus. And I'm like, really, this is 2021 and you're making us read this right now in the middle of, you got to read the room, right? We got to learn that times are changing and that the story just was not appropriate for the moment. Plus the book just wasn't good, but I think that was my issue. Erin, if I could turn to you for a second, looking ahead, how do you see emerging technologies and storytelling changing education and changing in education?
I mean, I think it depends on which emerging technology you're pointing to, right? If it's AI, mm-hmm. I don't see anything good coming from that. Right? Like we just got the MIT study showing that students who use AI to write essays have decreased cognitive capacity. You know, AI is not a substitute for creativity or for critical thinking. If we're talking about emerging technologies in terms of things like, I mean, I think podcasts have fully emerged. I don't know that they're emerging, but the shift towards video and some of the more creative, you know, some of the things that I see our students in our entertainment media production program doing where they are playing with not just genre, but platform, right? Like, can we shift between an audio medium and a video medium? And can we, you know, what is the website component that goes along with this? And so I think that storytelling and technology are really integrated for many of our students, right? Like, they assume that if they are watching a piece of media and they want more of it, they will be able to turn to fan fiction, or somebody will have made a fan video, or there mm-hmm. will be some wraparound from, it's sort of the same as when the Star Wars movies were coming out and before the franchise really got rebooted, right? There were all of those Star Wars novels. Right. And so when you were done with the movies, you could turn to the novels, right? And you could live in the novels. And then maybe there were comics, right? And so there's this sort of sense that whatever genre or media type a story started in, it won't stay there, right? It's permeating everything kind of. And that's the expectation. And there's something really interesting about that because I also see sometimes creators try to resist that in certain ways and try to control where the narrative can go. And I think that's almost always a mistake. I think the resistance, like all you're doing is encouraging at that point, right? You have to let people retell stories. We want to retell stories. We want to play with the characters. We want to play with the world. We want to think about, okay, what if this had happened? And I think that's a sign of a good narrative, a good story, something that's engaging and that is productively reflecting our society and making people think. So in that sense, I think technology can be really helpful. It's just when we turn over that thinking piece to AI that I think it starts to go all downhill.
No, absolutely. I think there's a high trend in transmedia, especially right now, going from, like you mentioned, comic books to film to books to streaming platforms. You're watching cartoons, you know, Star Wars has got, you know, the Bad Batch and these little half hour shows, and you've got the 3 hour movies and everything. So you've got a certain aspect that can come about. And I think streaming is just taking us to a whole different level that we could just talk about for another 6 hours. However, unfortunately, we are coming to about the time of our episode. So first of all, I want to thank you, my two friends, Michelle, Anya, and Jabig. I did that again. Michelle, Anya, and Jabig.
Right? Got it.
Okay. And Aaron Mann, thank you so much for joining me today. I had a fantastic conversation talking about the world of literature and fiction and writing. And you guys actually taught me a lot, not going to lie, that I really enjoyed. However, before we leave, before I let you guys jump off, I've been ending each episode with rapid fire questions. So I'm going to hit each of you with rapid fire questions. Just tell me your first thoughts. Okay, that's all I want.
Oh, God.
Okay, I'm going to go back and forth. Aaron, I need like, I keep saying this, I need a sound effect here, like drrr, like a drum roll or something. Aaron, digital or physical books?
Digital. Specifically audio, but I also love an ebook.
Michelle, what was your favorite story series as a child?
Redwall.
Love it. Aaron, if you were an author, what would your pen name be?
Oh, God. I don't know. Something really old-fashioned, like Imogen Wilby. I don't know.
Ooh, I like that. Michelle, happy ending or tragic ending?
Never ending.
Never ending. Ooh, I like that. Aaron, when you had those physical books, did you dog ear or did you put in a bookmark?
I am a chaotic bookmarker. So it's like whatever receipt is nearby, or like the two books that are sitting half read on my desk have pencils marking my, like they're just in there.
I love it. And Michelle, which author, living or dead, would you want to have dinner with?
Ursula K. Le Guin.
Ooh, good answer.
15 more to dinner party? Sure. I mean, yeah. Can Aaron and I come though?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so we got 17 now. So we're
good.
Yeah. Well, thank you again, my friends, for joining me today. Listeners, check out, we got one final episode left on Disney. Yes. And check out the 6 previous episodes before. As my friend Mickey Mouse says, we will see you real soon.